Mr. Rhonda, could you tell me where and when you were born?
I was born in Toronto in 1910.
When did your parents, were your parents a Toronto family also?
No, they were both born in Finland, had come to the United States about 1891, and then moved up to Toronto in 1893. They came singly to the United States and were married in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And then a couple of years after that, they moved up to Toronto.
Mm-hmm. What was your father's occupation?
He was a tailor. And he and my uncle ran a clothing company in Toronto and had one in Ann Arbor. And then when they came to Toronto, they continued on in that kind of business for some years.
Did your father, was your father in the First World War?
No, he wasn't. No.
A little too old, was he?
Yeah, I think he was a little too old, he had a lame leg, which would have kept him out in any event.
Did you attend high school in Toronto then?
Yes. You know,
Toronto was really your home city.
That's right. And to what was called public school in Toronto, too.
Yeah.
That's the ordinary grade school. In fact, that's where I started off in cadets at that time.
You joined high school cadets?
No, in public school. We used to have cadets starting off about the maybe the sixth grade or something like that, and I was in cadets from the time that I could get into them until I left public school, and then continued in cadets in high school.
Oh. What were your major interests in high school? Did you have any idea you'd go into your extensive medical career?
Yes, pretty well. I decided quite early to go into medicine. I had a favorite brother of mine who was already in medicine. He had graduated in 1923, and he's 10 years older than I am, and he had gone through medicine when I had very close contact with him, and I learned a lot even at that time from him, because he was a good conversationalist, and we used to talk a lot together, and I guess that's the main interest that I had, although the other effect, I suppose, was our own family doctor, who is a person that I did and do much admire, and he died several years ago now, but he died when he was about 96, and Dr. Cuthbertson, used to think that he was a great god, really.
Did your family support the idea of you going into medicine?
Yes, my father died when I was 17, and my brother was the one who was then practicing in Pittsburgh, who helped me financially, and my father's estate really helped me as well.
You had an early interest in art too, didn't you?
In which?
In art.
Yes, yeah, I had carried on some training in art, both in high school and at the Grange Gallery in Toronto.
But that never deflected you from medicine, though?
No, because I've always felt that art is sort of part of medicine. I I suppose it's well known that occupationally and from the point of view of avocations, individuals in medicine have a high interest in art, in literature, and so on. But many doctors practice these as sort of side activities.
You joined the Mississauga Horse Guards in 1926. You'd still have been in high school when you joined.
Yes, that's right.
How did
right.
they come about anyway, and what are the Horse Guards?
Well, I joined up there largely because of the fact that I was an officer in the cadets at high school, as I had been in public school. One of my close friends who went to public school and to high school was also an officer, and he had joined the Mississauga Horse Guard, and he was the one who introduced me to it, and we used to parade in the armories on University Avenue, and it was a regular cavalry unit, a militia cavalry unit.
You got paid for it?
Yes, a small amount. I was a trooper, whatever we got in those days, a dollar, a quarter, and a quarter, or something like that. We went to summer camp for 2 weeks in the summertime at Niagara on the Lake, which was mainly a horsey summer camp, you know, because although we did have horses one evening a week for maybe 10 or 15 times in the course of the year, the main cavalry exercises took place at Niagara on the Lake.
Were these cavalry exercises actually military exercises, or were they more ceremonial?
Oh no, they were military exercises, yeah.
Wasn't cavalry by this time regarded as obsolete, you know, in modern warfare?
No. At least it wasn't in our unit, and it was considered still to be a mounted light infantry. That's really what the Mississauga Horse Guards were. It's the same way as the Dragoons were at that time, were mounted light infantry.
Firing rifles from the horse?
No. Purpose of it was to give mobility to the man and get him to a strategic place, either for observation, and we were trained a good deal in field craft because our purpose was observation and reconnaissance, plus the mobilization of firepower at some strategic point with the faster movement of the horse.
Field craft, what crafts? Yeah,
well, field craft was mainly on the basis of observation of terrain, features of the terrain that may be of use in a military sense on smaller maneuvers, not on the basis of the main strategy of battle or anything like that, but just the sort of unit tactics that may be needed in order to probe a particular area. And the purpose there was to observe terrain. I guess ever since Waterloo, the importance of terrain has been considered to be the job of the cavalry because and as it is in tank warfare now, the terrain in covering, in causing difficulties for advancing troops, is something that you can't do without. You have to have that kind of reconnaissance, and this was the task that was given to cavalry in those those times. Truly, not a very good thing in the face of modern warfare, but certainly something that was in those days still considered to be worthwhile exercising.
Mm-hmm. You rose to the rank of you did rise to rank, didn't you, in this?
No, to a corporal, yes, that's right, yeah.
Did you contemplate a career in the armed services at
no.
that time?
No, I didn't, okay. No.
Did you have any other associations with the military, though, after cadets, after the
after
Horse Guard?
No, I didn't. Not until I started to work with the COTC. I didn't belong to the COTC in the University of Toronto. And I guess the reason for that was that during the my last year at high school and my first couple of years at university, I was with the Mississauga Horse Guards. And I never did get around to going into the COTC.
Were you interested in the military, though?
Well, I don't know. Sure, I guess I was interested, but not in a career sense.
Which year did you enter the University of Toronto?
In 1929.
And you were determined at that stage to go right through and become a doctor.
That's right, yeah. And I started off in medical school. You see, in those days, you didn't go to arts to start off with. The course for the first 2 years combined an arts course with the pre-medical courses, and it was a six-year program rather than a four-year program such as it is at the present time.
When you graduated on the six-year program, did you decide you didn't practice medicine, though, did you?
No, because I went directly from there to the Riverdale Isolation Hospital, and this was because I had an interest in bacteriology and had been taking special courses in the course of and maintained a special interest in infectious problems during the time that I was a medical student. And then I, in my last year as a medical student, I started to work out at the Riverview Isolation Hospital, largely to run their laboratory. They had a small laboratory there. And while I was taking the occasional classes that we had at Riverview Hospital at Riverdale Hospital, that would have been in my fifth year in medicine. During my sixth year in medicine, I actually lived out at the Riverdale Hospital and did some, like a clinical clerk, worked with patients, served as sort of the admitting officer when the regular house staff were off duty. And then I was invited to go there for my first year after graduation, which I accepted. And because of my interest in infectious diseases, and also because it was the highest paying job that a medical, at least a recent graduate, could get.
This is what got you on the road to research then, as opposed to actual practice.
That's right, yeah. Because by this time I had a a lot of friends in the research field because I would spend my spare time investigating little projects, and I would haunt their laboratories and use a corner of their laboratories for my own activities.
That was in the Depression, too. Was money hard come by for?
Oh, sure, it was. Yeah, it was hard come by. The cost of living again had been going up during that period of time, and just prior to the Depression, and my brother had, however, been assisting me, and he was a pretty successful practitioner in Pittsburgh, and I really can't say that I suffered. I was strapped, but not suffering. Which I regard sort of the usual life of a student, that you're not suffering but strapped.
I see. Yeah. Did you have any interest in international affairs in the 30s?
Other than the fact that I came from an interesting ethnic group, and therefore my contacts with people that were coming from, I was aware of a Europe, you see, and largely because my parents had been very closely associated with the Finnish churches in Toronto, and after my father died, my mother's interests were mainly in the church, and I used to help out there. I taught English for years in the church. My parents had been largely responsible for the development of three of the Finnish language churches in Toronto, and at one of those, the Church of All Nations, I taught maybe for 6 years. I taught English to new Canadians, Finnish new Canadians.
You're quite fluently bilingual, right? Could
yes.
You read and Finnish as well as
yes.
speak?
Yes. But this had been, I was the youngest child of the family, but a pattern had already developed at home by the time I was born that we, spoke both languages, but we spoke at different times of the day, and my parents spoke Finnish in the mornings and at lunchtime, and English in the evenings, and the family, this pattern had been set up long before I arrived on the scene. So that I just fell customarily into that, and I remember on a number of occasions, when the kids were coming home from school, they had something exciting to say, and they were now used to speaking in English, and they'd start telling my mother some happening, and my mother would say, in Finnish, you know, I'm sorry, I don't understand you. I only speak Finnish in the mornings.
How about the international situation as it was developing? Were you aware of the situation in Europe and Germany and in Italy? Did you feel there's a threat to international peace? Do you remember?
Yes, I think that I had become I suppose I was more aware of the Eastern European threat than of anything else. This is largely because the news that we were getting that was first-hand news was Finnish, Russian, Russian, Polish kinds of pressures. And I remember when the quite a considerable concern that I had and a number of other students had as well about the Polish corridoring that took place recognizing this as being something that had threats of real problems arising in the eastern part of Europe, where indeed they started. Mm-hmm. And I think we had, among the Finnish people, we had an awareness of this problem, but as people who were sort of looking on at something that was much bigger than any Finnish national would recognize, but seeing that there is a real hazard developing in that area.
Who did you see as a major threat then, from a Finnish point of view? Were you more worried about, say, Finland being absorbed by Russia, or possible, say, German aggression and expansion?
I guess more in terms of the threats that what might happen, not so much from the Russian point of view, because I think Finns are aware that the Russians find the Finns pretty unpalatable to absorb, and the same holds true as far as the Swedes are concerned, but the Germans never did learn that lesson, and certainly not during the First World War. The Russians have always found the Finns quite unpalatable, and I don't think that the Finns really feel that there's any major threat. And certainly when I was in Finland not long ago, that attitude seems to prevail even yet. They're very wary of this giant that they have beside them, but they are not overly concerned about being absorbed.
I wonder if you personally felt any sort of conflict when Britain declared war upon Germany, because Germany was helping, shortly after, and he was helping Finland.
I don't think so. No, because having been raised in a Toronto environment, which had Germany as the enemy between the wars, I don't think that I had any feeling of tearing between the two, because I was fully Canadian, although I did have these other interests there, but they were what I would call interests but not nationality.
I see. Yeah. In 1939 you moved to Vancouver. How did
yes.
that come about?
I had, after I graduated, I did another year of training at St. Michael's Hospital, and during that period I had still continued to work doing research, my own small research projects in the lab of St. Michael's Hospital, and somehow, I don't know how this particular part of it occurred, but I was invited then to go back to university to take my public health degree in association with some additional work that they wanted me to do in the course of a summer project after I got through my training year. And I left directly from St. Michael's Hospital at the end of June, and then worked the summer until the beginning of September on a special project with Dr. De Vries, who subsequently became the director of the School of Hygiene. And this was at the School of Hygiene, and with which was associated with Connaught Medical Research Laboratories. Well, I then went back to school again for the following year in the School of Hygiene, but still continued to do research projects in the School of Hygiene section. And it was toward the end of that year that Dr. DeVries one day invited me into his office and asked me if I'd ever considered moving from Toronto and if I'd like to take a job at the University of British Columbia, part-time teaching and continue on with research with the Connaught Medical Research Laboratories, of which there was a division at the University of British Columbia. And an individual who was here, Dr. Claude Dolman, was here at the university, whom I knew by reputation, and he was working on one of the interests that I had in Toronto, and I thought this would be a great opportunity of continuing my research in this particular area. And he was quite a noted authority in the kinds of infectious diseases that I was interested in. So I came out here and had a half-time appointment with the University of British Columbia and a half-time appointment with the University of Toronto as a member of Connaught Medical Research Laboratories. And I did my research for Toronto and my teaching for UBC.
What particular types of bacterial infection then were you really interested in?
I was interested in streptococcal disease when I first came out here, and staphylococcal disease. It was the staphylococcal area that was particularly the area in which Dr. Dolman had been working in. And I was working on the exotoxins, the released poisonous materials from both of these organisms, but mainly concentrating in the streptococcus, trying to correlate the ability of the organism to produce disease. And this was, of course, in the days prior to the time of the development of antibiotics or even of sulfa drugs. I was trying to correlate the way in which the toxins released by the organisms produce disease in man, and was particularly interested in the streptococcal organism's ability to pick out certain elements of the kidneys as the place that it would attack.
War broke out this time in well, when you arrived?
September, in yes, that's right. I had arrived in June and war started in September.
And you were quite heavily involved in wartime research, weren't you?
Yeah, this is what we were directed to do through our association with Connaught Medical Research Laboratories. Connaught became one of the basic arms of research in the bacteriological field, and I got involved with this research in a number of capacities. My main area was in those diseases that are of significance to armed forces people, namely the diseases that attack the intestinal tract. And that moved me then into the area of cholera infection, and we were the only people really in North America at the time of the outbreak of the Pacific War to be working in this particular field. I remember we had just developed a cholera vaccine at that time, a new kind of cholera vaccine, which was much more, this had been given to us as a task, which was much more effective than the old cholera vaccine. And our main contribution there was in devising a test that could be used to determine whether cholera vaccine was any good or not.
Was this, research into cholera vaccine useful for the Canadian troops that went to Hong Kong and Singapore?
Yes, the we had just developed a proven kind of vaccine. In other words, we had a small production that was going on in our laboratories. I was producing 1,500 doses a week. And within days after Pearl Harbor, we received a wire from headquarters in Toronto, that is the headquarters of Connaught Medical Research Laboratories, telling us that they had had an order from the United States Army of several million doses of cholera vaccine, and how long would it take us to produce them. Well, working at 1,500 doses a week, well, that was going to take into about 1,980 or something to do. So we developed a technique then for the large-scale production of cholera vaccine, which was done in Toronto, and then we continued to do the testing and the release of batches as they were produced in Toronto. Well, by the time our people began to go to the Pacific front, most of them had cholera vaccine as a as part of their immunization series, and we had a number of instances in which civilians going over as well, prior to the time of the actual Japanese invasions of the southern part of the Pacific Rim, in which we had given them doses of cholera vaccine. Now, this doesn't have a very long immunization. It probably doesn't immunize for longer than 6 months to a year, but it may set the pattern of the antibody reaction that will speed it up in case an individual gets contaminated with the organism.
How about malaria?
No, I was never involved in malaria.
Was your research under the Department of National Defense?
No, it was under the Connaught Medical Research Laboratories, which was working with, and we did a lot of work for defense. I was responsible for the bacteriological study of the Japanese balloon bombs that came over to the Pacific coast here from Japan. And this was a great hush-hush business that was going on. They were afraid that they might use them for bacteriological warfare or something like this. And we were tied in with that particular aspect of the studies of that were going on in various parts of the world.
Luckily, in World War II, no bacteriological warfare was ever employed in any area.
No, but everybody was ready for it, and I suppose in the major pattern of things, our work was all devised along these lines as well. we had mechanisms of mass production of organisms, and we knew the limitations of the organism. We also had an improved defensive mechanism for it, which had not been published during the war, but which was published following the war.
Do you think because of the terrible consequences of it, it was kind of a detriment on both sides to refraining?
Any serious-minded bacteriologist would ever suggest, either on our side or on their side, that bacteriological warfare was a particularly healthy business to get into for either side, because you can't control the boundaries of it. Even the boundaries of an atomic bomb are much more defined than the boundaries of bacteriological warfare.
In your opinion, then, bacteriological warfare was really out of the question.
Because we also felt that it was an agency that could be used, and though our work was not by any means in the area of the worst possible things that could be done, but we studied among the diseases that we studied was typhoid and all the salmonella diseases, cholera, brucellosis, which is a dreadful kind of disorder. Fortunately, not one that is likely to, or would be likely to be used in biological warfare, but something which we had to learn about, even to know how to handle it within the laboratory so that everybody doesn't get infected, which was at one time the fate of people who worked with brucellosis.
Did you ever give advice to any people in the military or their associated agencies regarding hygiene for soldiers?
Yes. One of the projects that I had referred to an epidemic that had occurred among some soldiers, which was traced to cheese, and this because of the high demand for cheese, the cheesemakers were turning out cheese that was still fairly green, and we defined the storage period that was necessary before before the armed forces would purchase cheese. In other words, it had to be dated when it was set up, and the cheese also had to be aged to a certain age, 6 months, before the armed forces would buy them or use them. And the reason for that was that in our studies of Canadian cheddar cheese, which was the main thing that bought by the armed forces, we discovered that typhoid organisms die off in that period of time in cheese. And this was on the basis of actual experiments that we carried out using University of British Columbia cheddar cheese that was produced right on the campus. The interesting problem there was that that turned me off cheese for about 4 or 5 years after I worked on that for 6 months or so.
Were these just sort of ad hoc research, or were you part of any regular military, any sort of a council that would...
No, not as a part of the council, but we were tied in with Connaught Medical Research Laboratories, whose total energies were directed toward the military benefit, or the national benefit, associated with the war effort. Even when penicillin started to be produced, well, Connaught Laboratories was the laboratory that was called upon to produce it. Now, it was done in Toronto, but we were associated with those conferences that went on had our input into those conferences in terms of production methods.
What year was penicillin used?
1945.
Yeah. So it didn't really play any part in the war then?
Well, it did in the early, at least early in that year. I guess 44 when it started to be used experimentally, but it was in huge production at the end of the, by the end of the war, and these production methods had been developed in the course of the war.
Do you think it would have made a lot of difference in terms of saving lives if it would have been discovered in 1939, say, or used at that time?
Well, there are a number of, yes, it would have had a, in the early part of the war, it would have had a quite a considerable influence. Its main influence would be in preventing complications that arose from surgery, where extensive surgery had to be attempted. The antibiotics are really the thing that gives the surgeon his safety factor, even as it is today.
Did you have any liaison at all with COTC prior to when you joined them?
For 2 years prior to 1944 when I joined them, I had been on their fieldcraft instructional staff as a lay instructor. And this was largely because of my previous familiarity with it, having been a cavalryman, you know.
How about in terms of your time, though, available? Obviously, you're very deeply into research.
Oh, yes. I didn't have a great deal of time to devote to it. And however, I got out once a week during those years, and this could only be done during good weather, you see, so that it was limited to a bit in the spring and some in the summer and some in the fall.
How did it come about that you offered your services?
I didn't offer my services at all. I was asked to give my services.
Who asked you?
Gordon Shum.
How did he know, how was he aware of your experience?
Well, I suppose we had talked, you know, I'd been there since 39, and the faculty was fairly small, and everybody knew one another, and he was a Toronto grad, and I suppose he just heard that I had been in the cavalry before, and knew that I had some interest in fieldcraft and outdoor activities, and he said, why don't you come and do some instruction? So I devised a little course and adapted it from what I remembered of the fieldcraft side of cavalry, and we devised methods of expressing terrain and observation of topographical things and measurements and estimates of measurements and this sort of thing.
I see. April of 1944, you joined the COTC. How
That's
did that
right.
come about?
That was because I was asked to join because of George Lamont asked me to join. And
he was what, senior medical
officer? He was senior medical officer. Now, I had become acquainted with him. He was the only person in Vancouver that I had an introduction to at the time that I, other than Claude Dolman, whom I was going to be working with. Bob Wilson was a contemporary of mine at Connaught Medical Research Laboratories, and he had been put through medical school by Dr. George Lamont. And he was working in Toronto during the 2 years that I'd been associated with Connaught Laboratories. And when I was sent out here, I was actually sent out on loan to UBC, to the Western Division of Connaught here. And some days before I left, Bob Wilson said, well, George Lamont is there, be sure and get in touch with him. So I contacted him a month or two after I got to Vancouver, and we became quite good friends over the years, and he asked me one day, he said that I'm looking around for medical officers, where the unit was large, and a couple of his people had, who were in the public health department here, had been sent overseas, and he asked me if I would had time to give him a hand. So that's the way it happened.
Mm-hmm. What rank were you taken on as?
A captain.
As a captain?
Yeah.
How come you're given such a high rank starting?
Well, that was the regular rank.
You know, for a medical
for
officer?
For a medical officer, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
What were your duties then when you started?
Doing physical examinations during the, for all of the recruits coming in, taking care of people at summer camps. In fact, the main reason why I went was because we were, the unit was going over to Courtney, to the Combined Operations School for training, and George was overburdened with the number of people there. Besides, he going to a combined op school, he was concerned as to just what problems he would be facing with. He was a pediatrician, and he wanted to have a few more people around, and he got a chap who was an orthopedic surgeon, myself, and we were the three medical officers then responsible for the whole camp, and we sure had lots of problems too. You know, we would sometimes have 8 or 10 patients in the little Courtney Comox Hospital there with a variety of problems, but we sure used our orthopedic surgeon too.
That would have taken you away from Vancouver for 3 weeks.
About 3 weeks, yeah. Well, that was while we were in and out of Vancouver on a number of occasions as far as Connaught Laboratories business was concerned, but that was the longest time really that I had been away from Vancouver since the time when I first came.
What was the orthopedic surgeon especially used at the camp?
Well, it was a combined operations school, which meant you know, obstacle courses and water landings. You know, they're really training for the Pacific by that time. They thought they were going to have to take Iwo Jima again or something like that, and the whole training system was based on amphibian landings, and we went into the camp after a a unit from Quebec had been there, and the instructional staff pushed them very hard. Whether they ought to have been pushed hard, I don't know, but they continued to push our people, and our people were more willing than they had strength to be willing. And we had in the first two or three days, we had a broken leg and a dislocated hip. We had a couple of broken arms, broken collarbone, various bruises and cuts and this sort of thing. Just because, you know, having sat in school for a whole year, and then being moved out of there and starting to go over obstacle courses and this kind of thing, which were really combat obstacle courses, some of them just didn't have the strength, and they fall off the obstacle course. And one fellow, the fellow that that dislocated his hip, fell into a barbed wire from about 16 feet up, and unfortunately, in falling into the barbed wire, he pulled his leg up, and he landed with all his weight on one leg, and it was twisted over, and he lost his hip on that. That was the most difficult problem that we had to cope with, really. Mm-hmm. The fracture wasn't nearly as difficult.
What were your more routine duties during the year with the Corps?
Physical examinations and medical counseling of anybody, plus the fact that I guess a year after I, well, less than a year after I was, I joined the unit, I was PMC, and that I did a lot of work associated with that in running the mess.
Did you give talks to the men on hygiene or anything like that?
Yes.
You did
give
lectures?
Yeah. Hygiene, venereal disease, all the things associated with military affairs, plus the safeguarding of food and water and everything associated that an officer ought to know in looking after his men.
Did you sometimes take a group for special counseling before an exercise or before they go out on something and say, here are the problems you're going to run into as far as, you know, your health is concerned?
We would with the officers. Prior to going to camp, when we were aware of any particular problems that one might be associated with, our camps were pretty civilized places. We did call a special meeting. It wasn't before camp, but about 3 days after camp started at Courtney, we had the commanding officer call a meeting of the instructors plus our officers, and we were the ones who had recognized that the instructors were pressing our people too much, and that they perhaps didn't understand that these were willing kids and didn't have to be pushed, that they would do more than they really ought to do at that stage of the development. Our problems almost promptly disappeared at that stage. And this was, I remember George Lamont and Bruce Reed particularly were the ones that spoke at that time, because they were one the senior medical officer and the other the orthopedic surgeon. Defining the difficulties that we were encountering because of really the kind of training that they were being put into so early in the week. All that we were asking for is to wait until the last week to push them when they developed a little bit of muscle.
I see. Yeah. You rose from the rank of lieutenant to major during the war. Did you take courses for that?
Yes. Yeah.
Courses.
Yeah.
What kind of courses?
Well, these were the regular courses, moving to a field officer. I think this is what it was called, captain to field officer course.
Not along medical lines in any sense.
Oh no, no.
General military.
This is general military course that everybody has to take who moves to a field officer position.
Why did you take this direction then of enhancing your rank with the Corps?
Well, I guess because it was expected that George Lamont was leaving, and I had been selected then to stay on as medical officer for the unit, and in order to get the promotion that I needed to have, well, I had to take the course. And
who selected you, and why did you choose to?
The commanding officer,
Colonel Shrum, then.
Yeah.
Asked you if you.
That's right. Yeah, because Gordon Shrum, at least Lamont was planning to retire.
Why did you accept?
Well, I was interested. Yeah. I was interested in the unit and felt that it was a good thing. I had a very, very positive attitude toward the COTC. I thought it was a great unit for students to belong to. I felt that it, and I had seen many examples of people who had been benefited by the unit. Both in a personal sense, as well as in their awareness of the world around them. In a personal sense, I mean in their abilities to conduct themselves as social creatures, and as well as their abilities to be aware of the world outside of the university environment, which was a concern that I had all the way along in my university career, that students often stayed out on the campus and were only interested in what the campus had, that they didn't have an awareness of the world outside of the campus. And this is still my argument with the university.
Then the military offers another, or COTC offers another, is another institution.
That's right. Yeah.
Brings in contact with other factors.
Sure. And there are all kinds of people, even as I look at my own associations, there are all kinds of people that I would not have met or have become as closely involved in or closely involved with if I hadn't belonged to the COTC.
Do you somewhat make it a point in your own personal life of associating with people in other fields than
yes,
you're related
yeah,
to?
Yeah. Other than the ones that I have to work in, yeah. And
so
that's why I belong to many voluntary agencies, have served on the executives of agencies and actually created agencies where they didn't exist before, where there was a need.
That's it. So, in accounting for your very long interest in COTC over 20 years, and this is a main thing, you really believed it was an institution that was a very great benefit.
Yes, indeed.
And you had a lot of satisfaction being part of that.
A lot of satisfaction in being part of it, and felt and still feel that it was a serious mistake on the part of the country to abandon the COTC.
Can I get some of your impressions of the COTC during the war? Was morale good? Was it well efficiently running, in your opinion?
Yes. I was. I learned about administration from the COTC, I think, although I had been trained. The training in the in my public health course is to a large extent administrative, because this is what public health is all about.